Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. My name is Fernando Arencibia, and with me, as always, is the ever-supportive Jennifer Wollman. Jennifer, say hi.
Hi.
So today we have a very, very special guest with us today and a very special episode. And we're going to talk about one of the most important things in commercial investment, which is where to get your money to invest in commercial real estate. Jennifer, you want to introduce our guest?
Yes, I do. And before I get there, the background and the reason for this is because we're expecting 2025 to be a better year, both in terms of opportunity and in terms of the lending environment. So we wanted to make sure, as always, that you are prepared and have your professional team lined up. And so we couldn't think of anybody better than Sarah Hernandez. She is Senior VP and a commercial banker with First Citizens Bank, one of America's largest family-controlled banks, which I love. I love the idea that it's different. Most people think, oh, well, I'm going to go to one of the big banks, and we love our local smaller banks. Sarah's specific focus has been working with clients in the commercial and industrial space that are in the growth phase of the business cycle, and she has a special interest in the healthcare and medical industry. So welcome, welcome, Sarah. It's great to see you. We go back quite a ways. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what brought you here, and a little bit about First Citizens Bank.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is exciting. A little bit about my background. So I started in banking in the early 80s with Southeast Bank. Everybody's heard of Southeast Bank. And in the 90s, I was done with corporate America. I was 26 years old and I wanted to go on my own. And so I opened a mortgage company. I had a mortgage company, a residential mortgage company for 20 years. And I dabbled in the commercial, but it was strictly a residential shop, and had South Bay Lending for 20 years, had a great time. And then, you know, we had that little blip in the market. It was a little bit of a huge recession. And so what ended up happening for me, I just kind of downsized and it just stopped being fun. And then I got invited to come back into banking in 2013. And so I've been doing commercial since then, which was also great for me because having had a residential background, I needed to like really get into what commercial was about. And if I could do it, anybody could do it. Anybody could learn what commercial is like. And when you understand commercial, it's great because there's less emotion. It's all about the numbers. Does it make sense? Does it not make sense? Is this a good location? And that's it, right? Whereas residential, there's a lot more emotion. Anyway, so get back into banking, really enjoy that, where I get to do the stuff that I love, is putting the deal together and bringing in the business and someone else takes care of payroll. Also makes me very successful in working with my business owners, because I understand, you know, what they go through and how to create safety nets for them. First Citizens has been around for about over 125 years. It is a family-owned company that's publicly traded, but the company owns 80% of the shares. So it's very much about a legacy play for the holding family. This is a long-term play. This is not a bank that is going to be sold and resold and resold. On the contrary, we like to buy smaller banks or banks that are failed, because we have a nice method of being conservative and doing the right thing for the employees. One of the things that I love about First Citizens is they take care of us the way we take care of our best customers, right? So we're treated like a top-notch customer. That's a different take on the way other institutions take care of their employees. So it feels good when you're taken care of and you can take care of your customer. So that's a little bit about First Citizens and, you know, the state of banking right now. I know we'll get into it. Very interesting and excited to see what 2025 brings us.
You know, I know we're going to go into a lot of details on the kinds of loans that you get and the difference between an owner-occupied property versus an investor, you know, loan and how that's set up. But along the lines of what you have discussed, I think a lot of people, when they enter the commercial real estate sector, they don't understand the incredible value that a community bank provides. You know, like I remember when I did my first commercial deal, the bankers came to Little Havana. It was this 6-unit building in Little Havana. They came, they wanted to tour it. They wanted to see it. They wanted to experience it. They wanted to ask questions of the prospective owner. What is it that you're seeing in this market? What is it that you're seeing in this property? Why do you value it as such? And so there was really this idea that the bank is an investor in the property as much as the owner, right? And they want the owner to have a stake in it. But at the same time, they want to be a part of that. And we throw a lot of terms out there in our industry. And I think that there is something powerful about working with a community bank, working with a regional bank, you know, that really understands the market and really wants to get their hands dirty. So can you speak a little bit about that? Because, you know, some people think, well, I'm going to be better off going with a big bank. But in reality, in commercial, it's really the other way around.
Absolutely. So one of the things that's super important for the banker, and especially for us, is to, one, understand the property, understand the client. Why is it that you're making this investment, like what you just said? Does this make sense? And why are you invested in it? And so one of the things that we do, we have a local underwriter. Our local underwriter is in town, knows where Little Havana is, understands Wynwood, understands all these different sections of Dade County. And then, you know, when the loan is larger, then we get, and you know, we need a higher signature, we get the other underwriter that needs to sign off that may be out of market, we get them in market. We have them. One of the classic parts of being a lender is you got to kick the tires. You got to go out there and understand. Because when you see an appraisal is giving you a snapshot of this property, right? When you go out there, you can see what's going on. You can see if the retail business is doing well, if there's something down the street, if there's an incinerator down the block. You know, that's a pretty popular conversation we're having now. So there's all of this that goes on, and you want to be able to understand it. So it's super important to have the banker come out and see the property. And before you invest, you know, you need to understand the area. And that's why it's so important to be with a broker, you know, commercial broker that is taking you there and is understanding and can lead you through what's going on.
So can I just tell a quick story, because she triggered it in my mind. This is 4 or 5 years into my career in commercial real estate. We are looking to purchase a property right on 8th Street and about 12th Avenue, you know, that 12th to 17th Avenue area. And we're walking the area with the banker and we're explaining, oh, this is how we're seeing this. And he's like, but you got limited parking. I was like, well, you don't really need it here. Look at the hustle and bustle. Look at what's happening here. 1,000 visitors, a day that come into Little Havana. You know, we're kind of walking through this ball and chain. Those of you who know Little Havana probably know Ball and Chain was just getting renovated. So we're walking by. I know Bill Fuller, you know, the developer, co-owner, shout out to them. They've done a terrific job in Little Havana. And he walks us in and he's showing us and he's saying, look at this Cuban tile. We had to custom make it. And he's showing me this and that and all that stuff. And when we leave Ball and Chain and we continue to walking, the banker goes like, did you guys set this up? And I was like, no, this is totally one of those crazy things. But it's about what the banker got out of that was two things. Number one, that my client understood, you know, really what it is that he wanted to do with the space and how he was going to activate it. Number two, we had the relationships in the neighborhood. So that just gives them that sense of, hey, you're invested in here, and so I want to invest with you.
So I have a question, Sarah, related to that in the relationships, and then what you said about how you go with a potential buyer to look at the property. If it's something where you're not getting a good feeling, or there is an incinerator down the street, or whatever it is that's giving you pause on a loan, what kind of a discussion do you have with the potential borrower? Do you just say, no, this isn't for us? Or how do you work in that situation?
I think that being upfront and telling people quickly what you think, and the more seasoned you are as a lender, the more you understand how your underwriter is going to see stuff. So you don't have to go through a 30-day due diligence to know what the underwriter knows. And many times what we'll do, let's say we go out to a property and it's just not great, but there's XYZ that's going to happen. And there's a story behind it. You take it in, you're honest with the client. You say, listen, I hear you. I understand. I'm going to give it a shot. Let's have that conversation with the underwriter. Let's have a pre-flight before I ask you for any documents. Before I bombard you with a list of documents, let's have a quick pre-flight. We bring the underwriter on the line. We address the negatives, the positives, the mitigatings, and then we come to a consensus from that point. I like to do that early on. I like to sleep at night. I don't like to have things hanging or thinking that this is going to blow up. If it's going to blow up, let it blow up. The other thing that I, do a lot is, let's say that I got somebody that's asking me for something that I know is just not really in my wheelhouse. I'm going to tell him, look, this is not in my wheelhouse. I'm going to introduce you to X. They like this better than I do as a bank. And let's have that conversation with them. And then I make that introduction with the other banker that I know likes that kind of stuff, whereas I don't. I mean, so it's vetting quickly the opportunity.
So what kind of things are there, specific items that your underwriter looks for that you look for right away? Or is it super specific? Are there things that they're always wary of, just kind of as a checklist?
Every property, as you know, is unique. Every situation is unique. It's hard to say there's a checklist. And as you do more of this, a lot of it is, yes, you want the numbers to pan out, right? But then there's other things. Like, let's say you got a buyer who has never, ever, ever in their life managed a multifamily property. They've never done it. You know, they're out in an Ivy Tower and all of a sudden they want to become, a multifamily investor. That deal better be crystal clear, perfect, a very nice down payment, a very solid borrower for the bank to say, we got you, but I want to make sure you have a property manager. I want to make sure that you've thought this through, because chasing rents of 20, 25 units is not the same as renting a house. So again, there's a lot of common sense in underwriting. So it just needs to make sense.
Especially in commercial underwriting.
More than anything.
And you're kind of alluding to this, but can you explain to our listeners, there's a big difference between the residential and the commercial underwriting process. So in residential, you'll go to desktop underwriter. You're trying to underwrite to the Fannie Freddie Mac guidelines. There are some portfolio loans that are outside of the realm, but the bulk of your business is going to be that. In the commercial side, this is going to go in front of a loan committee. You're going to have a package prepared. How important is that preparation? I think the brilliance of a lender, right, as such as yourself, is understanding when the package is ready for prime time, right? When is it ready for the committee to actually see it, and what's going to trigger an approval or create some issues that need to be resolved? I would love for you to speak a little bit about that.
Great. So I'll tell you something. A good lender doesn't get a loan rejected, doesn't take a loan that's not going to get approved, right? Because they've done their due diligence. In our case, it's rare for a loan to be denied. If a loan gets to that point where it's being presented, everything's checked off, right? So, you know, one of the key things, the first thing is understanding the guarantors, having deep conversations with the guarantors, understanding their why. You know, why are they doing this? Why does this make sense? And if they're in another business, how is this going to supplement them? This is not going to take away from what they do. This is just going to enhance their income. And they've thought of that. And since they are a busy entrepreneur running a manufacturing company, let's say, they've thought about how they're going to have somebody come in and manage this property for them. And so they've thought about that. So that's one of the things you want to be real clear. Then you want to look at the leases. You want to have looked at the leases of the commercial property, understand the leases, understand what the renewals are. For example, if you've got a property that the leases expire in 2 years, you're not going to get a 10-year loan. You're not going to get a 7-year loan. Bank wants the lease and the loan to end at the same time. So these are little things that you think about and you deal with early on. You want to see about what type of repairs have been done in the building, what needs to be done. Anticipate it. Talk about it. Bring out the things that you think are an issue and have a mitigant for it. That really helps.
So let me ask you, because immediately I'm thinking, okay, so then that doesn't work for value add, right? So is that something then that's not in your wheelhouse, right? If somebody's going to buy a shopping center, like if I were an investor in a shopping center, I want 100% really low rents, but I want month-to-month leases or leases expiring soon so that I can go in, put the, you know, upgrade the property, increase the rents, etc. So those leases are not going to tie. The leases that are currently in place are going to be expiring probably over the next 1 to 3 years, and my loan is going to be longer. So how would you work with that?
So if this is the first deal that I'm doing for you, I wouldn't do it. I would say I'm not a good fit. If you are an established client of the bank and have had and own several shopping centers, and I've seen your track record and I know what you do, then that's a different conversation.
Hmm. What if I'm not with the bank, but I have existing shopping centers and I have the experience?
That's a mitigating. That's something that would be looked at, right? But again, everything right now, everything is about relationships. And it's about the bank knowing you, understanding you, having that trust, that partnership with you. And that goes a long way. I'll give you an example. We don't do Winn-Dixies. We don't do shopping centers with Winn-Dixies and stuff. I've done two shopping centers for a top client of ours that have Winn-Dixies. And, you know, Winn-Dixies, of all the grocers, Winn-Dixies was the lowest on the totem pole because it wasn't, you know, a Publix or something like that. And so, but because of the expertise of the client, I was able to get them done.
Because, you know, some people are going to listen to this and they're not going to understand the why, you know, you would look at the Winn-Dixie anchored shopping center so differently than a Publix anchored shopping center. Can you give us a little bit of a sense of why that is?
So we look at outfits, you know, companies, the way we look at a borrower. What is the strength of their financials? The strength of a Publix versus a Winn-Dixie is a different credit tenant. And I don't even think Winn-Dixie is a credit tenant. So in order to be a credit tenant, you have to be rated by this industry called Moody's, and then they give you an A, a B, just the way we grade everything, right? If you got an A, you're better on the scale. If you've got a B or a C, you're lower, right? And so that's the way we look at tenants the same way we look at borrowers. And we analyze them and say, well, Publix is a strong company. They've got good financials. If a Publix is in that shopping center, then we've got, you know, more confidence in the shopping center.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's one of the things that is not often discussed. When you have a great credit tenant like Publix, they usually will negotiate a better rate, a better deal. They also are going to be there longer. They're going to attract a lot of other tenants to the shopping center. So sometimes when you make those decisions, it's really not about the bottom line on a price per square foot of that property, but it is about all of the other intangibles that are a component of it. So even if Winn-Dixie is paying more per square foot than Publix, that does not make it a more enticing lending package for the bank.
That Publix deal, although bottom line may be less, it will bring you more than a Winn-Dixie deal.
So I want to connect, you know, I'm all about our kindergarten series and connecting the dots. And there's several things that you've said that if I were going to you with a deal, I can already see like, okay, she's not going to like a Winn-Dixie. But if I know this is a market that Publix has been trying to get into, I'm still going to take her this. I'm going to tell her my plan because I know. And to your point about leases expiring, connect the dots. If leases are expiring and you really want to work with this lender and you know that they want the longer term loans, have it in your purchase agreement that you're going to be allowed to go speak with those tenants mm-hmm. and negotiate the leases for longer or get new tenants in there. And now all of a sudden you've taken right. a shopping center that was a no for her. You've mitigated the circumstances yeah. and now maybe it's a yes, right? I have Publix lined up. They're signing or they've got at least an LOI. I've extended contracts, et cetera. So, you know, a no isn't always a no. It's just a no at the moment under these conditions. And if you have somebody like Sarah, who's very upfront and does the pre-flight, which I love that, and does the pre-flight with you, you're going to know, especially if you're an investor who believes in the neighborhood, believes in the product, and knows how to connect the dots, you're going to know how to work with Sarah to say, I know this is a no for now, but what if this, and this were to happen? And then all of a sudden you get to a yes.
It's really about, you know, the bank wants to make sure that the property is successful.
Right. Right. Which is the kind of partner you want in your lender, because they want the project to succeed as much as you do, right? Because to Fernando's point earlier, they're a partner in this. So we've spoken a lot over several episodes about how hard 2024 has been, how tight the credit has been for so long. There's a lot of talk currently about CMBS loan delinquencies across the country, less so in Southeast Florida, but still there because the loans went out in a lower interest rate environment. That being said, there's a lot of money out there to be deployed. So can you tell us a bit about how you would work with somebody, let's say an existing client or somebody who already has experience, to help them expand their business or real estate portfolio in 2025? Do you have special loans? I know you do work with 504 SBA loans. If you were helping somebody to expand, what would you?
Well, you know, I think the SBA 504 product is a great product. You can purchase real estate. Now, I'll tell you something which is really interesting. I've done an SBA for a hotel, because they consider a hotel an owner-operator business. So, which I'll tell you, it's super hard to get a hotel financed from a regular lender, even us, because of everything that happened during COVID and all that stuff. Even though they're doing great now, banks have like really long memories. They focus on what happened really bad. And so it takes them a while to erase those episodes. But with a 504, you can purchase a hotel with 10% down, right? You can do that. One of the other things that I find very interesting on the SBA that you can do is I've got a client that is in the industrial business. He has a lot of trucks and he needs land to be able to put those trucks. Nobody wants to finance raw land. However, through an SBA 504, you can finance the land, put a little trailer on it, and buy it with 10% down. And through this program, he was able to identify land and be able to put his trucks and his machinery and then have a small office on the land. So you just have to be creative and understand what's available. But the SBA is a great product.
What are the pros and cons? Obviously, a pro you've mentioned a couple times is the 10% down and the fact that it's, you know, you can finance properties that don't have the typical standard conventional financing. What are some of the other pros or what are some of the cons?
So one of the pros is that you can finance everything. You can finance the closing cost. You can finance the cost to improve the property. And they take all of that and then they'll go 90% of all of that. The cons are it's an expensive loan. And what ends up happening is you pay more fees getting into that loan. But if you look at the fees that you pay, the opportunity that you're getting and being able to finance it and not putting up all your capital, you know, the bulk of your capital, then although it's a con, it's not a terrible thing.
Now, you mentioned that it's expensive. Is it expensive because of the fees or are the interest rates also higher?
No, the rates are not higher. It's the fees. It's the fees. Yeah, yeah.
But like you said, you can wrap them into your actual mortgage, so you're financing or your loan, so you're actually financing the fees.
But there's also a big portion of your loan is long-term debt. Like 50% is long-term debt because it is guaranteed. So, you know, you do have within the framework, right, of the expense, there are financial benefits to the SBA loan, no?
Exactly. Yes. Because the first loan is the bank gives you the first loan. And let's say you get a 10-year fixed on the first. The second loan that is guaranteed by the SBA is a 25-year fixed. So that's difficult to get. That's a nice feature. Thank you for bringing that up, Fernando, because one of the worst things is, you know, having a balloon and not knowing what's going on. Like, I mean, all commercial loans are basically a balloon unless you get a 15-year fix. And most people can't afford a 15-year fix right off the bat on a commercial. The property doesn't cash flow for that. What you want to do is just, you know, a couple of years before the balloon, start working on it. That's another tip I would say. Don't wait until the balloon is about to mature. Start looking at it at least 24 months before and start gauging the market so that at any time during those 24 months before the balloon, you can refinance.
One of the things you mentioned, I don't want to gloss over it because I think a lot of people don't understand. It's one of the greatest things about the SBA loan, in my view, is that if you're an owner user, and let's say that you're going to buy a warehouse for your business, you get to do not only an appraisal of what the property is worth as is, but also if you have improvements that you want to make to the property, that you can value the property once those improvements are completed and then borrow on that total number. Can you go into that a little bit?
So let's say I'm buying a warehouse for my business. I need to retrofit the interior. I need to make larger bays, you know, the garage doors so that the trucks can come in. What we do is you get a cost breakdown from a contractor as to what is it going to cost to do this work. Then that information is given to the appraiser. The appraiser then will do two values on the property. We'll do a value of as is, if you didn't do any improvements. And if you did do the improvements, what would it be? And based on what would it be, then you can actually get like a mini construction loan to finish that. And then you've got the property all taken care of and you only had one closing. So yeah, that's a really great feature.
And then a last thing on the SBA. So you've got a 10-year and a 20-year fixed, two different components, which to me sounds great when it's a lower interest environment, right? Like, so everybody who took out a 504B when interest rates were low are doing a lot better off today, probably, than somebody who took out, for example, a CMBS loan or a conventional loan that's coming due, and now there's higher rates. In a higher rate environment, if you get a 504 SBA, how easy is it or how expensive is it to then refi that loan if the interest rates go down significantly?
So on the SBA portion, they have 10-year prepayment penalties because those loans were sold on the secondary market through like Ginnie Mae's and stuff like that. So refinancing the SBA, it's kind of tricky. You got to figure out where are you in the 10 years and if it makes sense to pay the prepayment. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does make sense to pay whatever the prepayment penalty is because the rate is going to be so much lower that you're going to benefit over the long run. The first loan, the 50% loan that comes from the bank, that's usually very easy to refinance. And truly, if you don't need to refinance it, you can go to the bank and say, listen, give me a rate modification. You know, just modify my rate to the market. We do it. We'll charge 0.25% and the market is better. We'll lower the rate to the market and not have to refinance and pay doc stamps again. So there's always a way. And that's a really good question, Jennifer. It's about finding out what are your options. Don't think that refinancing is the only option. Whenever you're presented with something, ask. Go to the experts and ask questions and get all the data before you make a decision.
Awesome.
It seems to me that many lenders are very bullish on the healthcare sector. And I know that you have a specialty in this. When we speak about loans that are specific to doctors or that are specific to people in the healthcare industry, I know that it's gone beyond just we have a great product for you to buy your house, doctor, but now we have a great product for you to buy your practice or for you to make investments. Speak a little bit about that, because it does seem to be, you know, right in line with, I think, the way investors look at the healthcare sector overall.
Absolutely. Now, I'll set up the example. Right now, office buildings are the worst asset class in the industry, right? The worst. Banks don't want to finance office building. And the reason why they don't want to finance it is because more and more people are stepping away from the traditional office space. Those leases that are coming due, people are not renewing it for the longer period of time, and they're reducing space. So you've got that office building. Now you've got a medical office building, right? If you've got a medical office building, a bank is going to be all over you. Doesn't matter who it is. They are going to want to finance that because medical office buildings have proven a couple of things. One, they're recession-proof. You can't do medicine from your home. You can do teledoc, but it's not the same thing. You know, there is that piece of the industry, but that's not going to take away from going to the office and seeing the practitioner, the doctor. That's not going to go away. So those things are really enhancing the value of a medical office building. So, I mean, it's common sense. So banks are very happy to lend on an office, a medical office building, all right? They may be shy on investors that, you know, doing speculative investment, right? And I'll talk a little bit about that right after this, because a lot of people don't understand what speculation when it comes to lending. But here you got a medical office building, fully rented. They tend to have long leases. They don't want short-term leases. They want their patients to know where they're going to be and that they're going to be there for a while. If you move patients around from one area to the other, they kind of lose track of where they're supposed to be, right? So they like the consistency. So long-term rents, banks love that. And recession-proof, can't get any better than that.
In Southeast Florida, we've had several medical facilities file for bankruptcy, and they're actually giving up space. So there was Steward Health, there's CareMax, there was another one. But, I mean, they get backfilled pretty quick. I know Humana went in and bought a bunch of the spaces, and same thing with CareMax. Somebody else moved in. But in a case like that, is there an opportunity for an investor to work with you to take a vacating medical space, or to your point, are you looking for some that are already rented and have the medical tenant in place?
Yeah, we would want to have a medical space that's rent. And the Steward issue was really bad management, right? And that, like, for example, if Steward had ever come to us and asked us for money, we would have never given them money, even though they are medical. Because when you look at the financials, you can see that it's mismanaged. And that's very much, you know, like a one-person decision because of the CEO, the way he managed that company. So Steward gives a bad name, you know, to the industry, but not really, because that's such an isolated situation when you come to medical.
Which goes back to the importance of screening the tenants and to your point of giving them an A, B, or C. So if you are an investor, having somebody like Sarah who can help you qualify, because obviously not all rented medical space is equal, depending on the tenant. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And so let me just finish on the healthcare real quick. So let's say that you're a doctor and you want to build an office building for yourself. That's something that we would do at 85% loan to value for a ground up construction. Again, very aggressive because medical, and you're going to stay in it. This is going to be your user. You're the user, right? So very bullish on that. Let's say you want to buy into a practice. You know, we'll finance the buy-in of the practice at 100%, right? So those are numbers and things that are very unique to the healthcare industry. And let me go back to the speculation. This happens a lot in Miami, where people see land and they want to build a luxury home and they want to sell it, right? And it's done well for the last few years, but that's the kind of lending that we would call speculative, and we would shy away from that. You see a piece of land and you want to build, you know, a $10 million home. First, this is not your business. You've never done this before, and you're going to do this now. I would caution anyone on taking that on. I'd rather see you invest in commercial real estate that is, you know, that has income producing versus waiting for somebody to buy this property for you.
So you've done a great job of giving tips for borrowers and medical professionals. What kind of tips would you give a broker for somebody who's bringing you a potential borrower for a property?
Great question. So what I would do is I would scout out who are the lenders in town and make sure that I met every top producer at every bank and created a relationship with before I had a deal. I would go to all the, I would take a list, figure out who the banks are, I would find out who's your top producer. Because that top producer has relationships with the underwriter that gets things done that the other guy doesn't. Right? So you want to create relationships with the top producers of the banks, and you want to then sit with them, take them to coffee, take them to lunch, tell them, listen, I don't have a deal for you, but I want to understand what kind of deals do you like? What is your sweet spot? So that I can jot you down, and when I get a deal that is your sweet spot, I'm not going to waste my time and call everybody. I'm going to call you. And now you know me. And now you're going to take my call, and we have a relationship. And I'm going to ask you, how do you like to see a deal? How do I best present something to you? Some people will say to you, listen, just give me a call. Let's talk about it. Let's schedule. Don't send me an entire package. Call me and let's schedule a call and tell me the particulars of the deal. Once you've done that, now you've created a rapport with that lender and go to the next one. Don't wait to have a deal to start creating relationships. Because if you do that, you're already behind the eight ball. It's too late. You don't know if that bank is a good match.
So do you have a sweet spot? We know your interest in terms of medical and healthcare and businesses that are growing their business. What about in terms of lending range? Is it 5 to 30 million? Is it 30 million and above?
We'll go anywhere from a million to 25 million within my sweet spot that I would feel comfortable. The bank, of course, has capacity to do much larger deals. I mean, we just did with Baptist Health, the rehab center right around South Miami Hospital. And I think that was like 50 some million. So we've got different divisions. But for me personally, I like to stay under 25. But again, you need to know and understand your lender. And that just makes you a better advocate for your client.
Absolutely. So, Sarah, we're at this time of year when we're looking at what 2025 is going to look like, right? And so I'm wondering, from your purview, what are your expectations of commercial lending and the commercial sector, real estate sector in 2025?
So I think what will happen in 2025 is as rates ease off a little bit, things will cash flow better. A big problem that's going on now is things aren't cash flowing. And so it's hard to justify dollars on a property when it's not cash flowing. Remember that on commercial, the property needs to stand on its own. It's not like where you use a global underwriting. You use global underwriting when it's owner-occupied. When it's owner-occupied, then I can use the income of your personal tax returns to offset the debt. But when it's strictly commercial real estate, I need to make sure the property cash flows. And with rates being where they are, it's hard. It's hard to pencil things. And also, I think that, you know, the sellers were wanting a certain amount and the property isn't cash flowing for that amount. So, and you know, it's very much of a stalemate. Things weren't moving. I think we'll see things move because something's got to give. Either the seller will realize, okay, I need to bring down the price. The interest rates helped me a little bit. And because on commercial, the key is that it cash flows.
All righty. So I know you're also an avid reader. And she also is a runner and likes to travel. So we're simpatico. So what is, I want to ask you two book related questions. What is the book that had the biggest impact on your life? And what are you reading now or the most recent book now that you would recommend?
So I would say that the book that had a great impact on my life is Fanatical Prospecting.
By Jim Blount, yeah.
Yeah. I have to tell you, it's like a masterclass for anyone in sales. And what I do is I have the physical book, but I listen to it on audio and I feel like I've got a coach just telling me, pick up the phone and just do it, right? So anybody that's hesitant to make phone calls or to prospect, this is a great, great book. And what I'm reading now, believe it or not, I was one of those students in high school that never read what I was supposed to read. And I am reading The Count of Monte Cristo, and I'm loving it.
Awesome. Look at that.
I'm loving it. I never saw the movie, and it's just fascinating. And what really intrigues me is that this book was written, you know, in the 1800s, and still today, it's captures you. It's really neat. So there you go.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. At the end of each podcast, at the end of each episode, we usually do a fun fact. So I was going to do a fun fact on something. I can't remember where it is. There it is. I have it up. It was about First Citizens Bank. And I just wanted to highlight some of their items. They're one of the top 20 financial institutions in the U.S. They have over 15,000 associates across the U.S., $200 billion in total assets, and 550 branches in 23 states. So I love that because even though it's a small community-owned bank, they're pretty much in your community. So.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much. You've been amazing. We really think that our listeners are going to get a lot out of this episode. So thank you very much. And thank you, everybody out there, for pulling up a chair and listening. You know, we really just want to say how incredibly moved we are by anyone who's out there listening to this and sending notes of support. We appreciate you. And until next time, Jennifer, say bye.
Bye. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.